Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour, an editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the professionals. When we come back. You know, over the past century, we Americans who were once independent, capable, and able to manage our own financial, medical, and legal affairs have now been reduced to dependents, incompetence, incapacity, and we have now been made wards of powerful commercial, financial, medical, and legal corporations, cartels, and bureaucratic institutions of our modern industrial society. And we've been taught to rely upon these paid professionals, you know, professionals like bankers to manage our financial affairs, and doctors to manage and treat our health problems, and lawyers to direct our business and legal affairs, instead of relying upon our own good common sense. That's why I contend that it's time that we Americans who were once able to catch our own fish learn once again how to fish, instead of being fed by these paid professionals. Regaining our power of attorney is the single most important step in regaining our capacity, our rights, our liberties, and our duties. Now, if you'd like to learn more about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you write for our free general law CD package? Remember, that's an educational, informative, and entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge CD package. Just call right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Professionals. Everybody, it seems, wants to be a professional. From the time I was a youngster, I was encouraged, beginning in about the third grade, that I needed to go to college. I never did, but I was told that I needed to. And today, people are told, young people especially, that if you don't go to college, you'll never amount to anything. And it seems like the politicians have jumped into the fray, and they want to make universal college education a part and parcel with the whole of education. And most people agree that people who are professionals make more money than people who are blue-collar workers or factory workers or just everyday, ordinary, garden-variety workmen or workwomen working here and there. And there's no doubt about it, the statistics are in, and of course, if you're a doctor, you probably make $200,000 or $300,000 a year. I've got a student here who's a doctor, and she mentioned the other day that she makes $200,000 a year. That's pretty heady stuff. But I got to thinking about that, and I said, well, gee, if everybody in America became a professional, I mean, just think about it for a moment. Do doctors repair their own toilets? Do they fix the leaks in their plumbing? Do doctors build their own houses or fix their own cars, change their own tires? No, sir, they don't. In fact, professionals don't do any of those routine, mundane things now, do they? I mean, think about it. Doctors, lawyers, preachers, ichthyologists, mathematicians, laser physicists, do those people fix their cars, make their beds, build their houses, roof their roofs, fix their leaky plumbing? I don't think so. I've never met one that did. Now, if everybody in America, there's 300 million of us here now, and if all 300 million of us had a degree from college, then who's going to do the work? It would seem like to me that we need to keep a certain number of people out here to fix the pipes, roof the roofs, and do the work out here, don't you? Now, I've never heard anybody laud or say a good word about a plumber, a carpenter, a truck driver. But, you know, those are the people that actually do the useful, meaningful, and productive work in the society. Yeah, that's right. The useful, productive, and meaningful work. Now, somebody's going to say, well, oh my God, doctors do useful, productive, and meaningful work. I don't believe that. And I think I can prove to you that that's not true, that professionals do not do any useful, productive, or meaningful work. None. Zero. Zilch. And furthermore, professionals are illegal activities. Well, not all of them, but most of them. Most of the professions are criminal activities that are prohibited in the scripture. But that's all right in our society because nobody gives heed to or pays attention to the scripture or God anyway, so we can indulge ourselves in these professions. But the professions, that is the three big professions, theology, medicine, and law, are three criminal activities. And as we go through some of the others, you know, things like archaeology and paleontology and geology and economists and mathematicians and astronomers, can you point out just what those people do that produces useful, productive, and meaningful work, which creates useful, productive, and meaningful goods and services that you and I need, can't live without, and ought not to have? I think we'll take a look at each one of these as we progress along, but as I pointed out, in professions and professionals is a criminal activity. I want to emphasize that the professions are criminal activities and that Jesus didn't have any letters. In fact, he was roundly castigated because he didn't have any letters. Now, today, people go around with, George Gordon. I saw a guy sent me a letter here one day, and he addressed me as Dr. Gordon. Dr. Gordon. God, that sounded good. Yeah, I'd kind of like to be a Dr. Gordon. You know, somebody with a PhD or a master's, or, you know, well, heck, even just a couple of letters behind my name, you know, like an MD or a DO or, a, you know, a something, to kind of set me apart from the crowd. Today, you've got so many college graduates out there that everybody's got a degree. I mean, if you want to get set apart from the crowd, you just tell them, hey, I'm a high school dropout. And they'll look at you like, oh my God, that guy's got the bubonic plague. Stay away from him. You don't want to get close to that guy. Doesn't have a degree. But let me read you the story here. It's in John chapter 7. You Christians can read this because it's in the New Testament. Oftentimes, you know, when I read something from the Old Testament, I get an email and somebody will roundly castigate me and tell me that the Old Testament was abolished and nailed to the cross with Jesus and taken out of the way and doesn't have any relevance in theology today. I don't think that's true, but even so, it's irrelevant here because this is in the New Testament, so all you Christians can pay attention. Jesus didn't have any letters. Did you know he never went to seminary? It's true. Jesus never went to seminary, didn't get a doctor of theology, and he was out here teaching and preaching and healing and doing all these things. And he stirred up a lot of hate and discontent in the process. And the people that he created all the hate and discontent with were the professionals. The average Joe six-pack camel driver didn't think that Jesus was a bad guy, but boy, you get to talking about the lawyers, the doctors, and the professionals, you know, the theologians over here. They were just really ticked off. He was practicing medicine without a license. That was one of the big things that really ticked them off. Then he was over here teaching from the scripture, and that made all the preachers mad. And then he threw the money changers out of the temple. That made all the bankers ticked off at him. Can you see why they killed him? I mean, they did the same thing to John Kennedy, you know, when he got uppity with the bankers and he thought he's going to start printing some bills over here from the Treasury instead of the Federal Reserve. I mean, you don't want to tick off the lawyers, the preachers, the doctors, and the bankers now, do you? I mean, that could get you killed. But here's the story. It's in John 7, verse 14. Now, about the midst of the feast, this is the Feast of Tabernacles. Jesus didn't keep Christmas, Easter, and New Year's, you know. He was up keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. That's an oddity, especially for Christians. You know, you ought to ask yourself, well, how come we don't practice the Feast of Tabernacles and the Passover and the Day of Atonement? And the answer is very plain. Because that's Jewish. Oh. It never occurred to anybody that Jesus was a Jew and he was practicing these Jewish customs over here, like Feast of Tabernacles. Maybe that was just as good as or a little better, you know, maybe than Christmas. But anyway, he was up here keeping the feast, and the Jews marveled, saying, "How knoweth this man letters, having never learned?" Or, how can this man know or have any learning, having never learned, having never been formally educated? You know, like we are, having been educated. You know, the Apostle Paul was an educated man. He studied law at the feet of Gamaliel. And so we know that the Apostle Paul, you know, he was a pretty smart guy. But Jesus, he never went to public school. He was homeschooled, home educated. Isn't that just special? But there's a little more to the story here. And in verse 16, Jesus answered them and said, "Well, my doctrine is not mine, but his that sent me." He didn't get his doctrine out of the Missouri Synod or from the Pope or somebody else. He said that somebody had sent him. And in verse 17, "If any man will do his will, he shall know of the doctrine, whether it be of God or whether I speak of myself. Now he that speaketh of himself seeketh his own glory, but he that seeketh his glory that sent him, the same is true, and no unrighteousness is in him. Now didn't Moses give you the law, and yet none of you keepeth the law? Now why do you go about to kill me?" That's quite a statement there. You know, we could say the same thing today. Now, you know, Moses gave us the law, and yet none of you keeps the law. None of you people out there practice the Sabbath or the holy days or keep any of the statutes, judgments, and commandments that we learned from Moses. We go to church, 65% of us here in America anyway, go to church every Sunday. And I imagine a big bunch of those go to church on Wednesday also. And so the Messiah asked you that question. He said, "Hey, how come you guys, you know, you got the law from Moses and none of you keep the law, and then you go about to kill me?" And the people answered and said, "Well, you know, you're crazy. You've got a devil. Who goes about to kill you?" And Jesus answered and he said to them, "Well, I have done one work and you all marvel. And Moses therefore gave unto you circumcision, not because it is of Moses, but of the fathers, and you on the Sabbath day circumcise a man. And if a man on the Sabbath day receives circumcision, that the law of Moses should not be broken, are ye angry at me because I have made a man every whit whole on the Sabbath day? Judge not according to the appearance, but judge righteous judgment," he said. And then said some of them of Jerusalem, "Is not this he whom they seek to kill? But lo, he speaks boldly, and they say nothing unto him. Do the rulers know indeed that this is the very Christ? Howbeit we know this man whence he is, but when Christ cometh, no man knows whence he is." Then cried Jesus in the temple as he taught, saying, "You know, you both know me, and you know not whence I am. I am not come of myself, but he that sent me is true, whom you know not. But I know him, for I am from him, and he has sent me." Then they sought to take him, but no man laid hands on him, because his hour was not yet come. And many of the people believed on him and said, "Well, when Christ comes, will he do more miracles than these which this man has done?" So the people there recognized that he was somebody. They didn't quite know who he was. There was a little discussion there going on, like, "Well, isn't this the Christ? Hey, doesn't Jerry Falwell and Oral Roberts and Jim Baker know who this is?" No, these religious people, they knew who he was, and they knew he needed to be killed. He was drawing followers away from him. I mean, you know, we can't have competition. And I want to point out that the people who sought to kill him were all the people that had degrees. These are the people that had letters. These are the people that were somebody in the society. Now, let's think about this for a minute, because when you take a look at the world today and the society in which we live, who gave us the war in Iraq? Was it the truck drivers working for Yellow Freight? Oh, no, no. It was the politicians in Washington. And can you name one politician in Washington from George Bush down that doesn't have a degree from college? You know, mull that one over a little bit. You know, the people that are giving us all the fits and all the problems, let's take a look at our economy over here. You know, with our bubble economy, Alan Greenspan, does he have a degree? Isn't he a college man? Ben Bernanke, you know, the new head of the Federal Reserve, did you think that he was an illiterate that came across the Rio Grande River? How about our attorney general, you know? No, he might be a Mexican, but he didn't swim across the river and take his job there at the Justice Department. That old boy has got a degree. He's been to college. In fact, if you think about it, you know, all of our leaders are college graduates. You know, the people that run the universities, the college professors, you know, the people that are teaching these people that have these degrees. It's the intelligentsia of our society that run this show, you know. It's not the plumbers, carpenters, and electricians out here that got uppity, you know, and wanted to go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. These aren't the people, you know, the carpenters, plumbers, and electricians. These aren't the people that gave us our bubbles in the economy, or that run the stock market, or the Securities and Exchange Commission, or issuing all of these no-bid contracts for Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root and Bechtel Corporation. Hell, those of us down here that have blue collars and are out here fixing the pipes and putting the roofs on your houses, all of us are smart enough to know that you need at least three bids before you can get the lowest price and the best product with the best service. Who came up with this no-bid program for issuing all of these contracts to these contractors over in Iraq? Weren't those college people? And who was it that gave us this Medicare program, you know, the new Medicare program that they want to give free drugs to all the senior citizens? Evidently, the elderly people, they need a lot of drugs. We need to drug all these people up, and we're going to give them free drugs. And so they don't negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies. They just pay full bore retail because the taxpayers are out here paying the bill. You know, just common sense would say that when you're going to buy something in quantity. Now, let's just take a look at an example. Just take the Veterans Administration. See, when they go to buy penicillin, they go to some pharmaceutical company. Maybe they go to GlaxoSmithKline and they say, listen, we need to buy 15 tons of penicillin next year. What's your price? And GlaxoSmithKline says, well, we got to have, $35 a pound, you know, for our penicillin, okay? And so then they go over to Pfizer and they say, hey, we want to buy 15 tons of penicillin next year for all of our veterans hospitals nationwide. How much are you going to charge us for penicillin? Maybe Pfizer says, well, we'll charge you $30 a pound. Okay, then maybe they go to Merck and they say, hey, Merck, how about this penicillin thing over here? We're going to buy 15 tons of penicillin next year for delivery to all of our veterans' hospitals. What do you got? And maybe they say $25. Now, let's take a look at the quality issue over here. Maybe they come over here to the Glaxo people and say, well, you bid $35, but what is it about your penicillin that's better than Pfizer and Merck? You know, after all, you're charging $35 a pound for it, so what's the story? And they may say, well, ours has more bacteria in it. Ours got more of this or that or something else in it. You know, we turn out a better penicillin. only takes half as much, you know, to cure pneumonia. So therefore, it's really a better value than that $25 stuff you're getting from Merck. So it used to be, and I'm an old-timey general contractor, and I'm just here to tell you, you know, that just because you want a linoleum floor doesn't mean that you're getting the best quality at the cheapest price. You know, there's different qualities of vinyl, you know, different qualities of workmanship that we can put in on this job over here, you know. But it used to be, when at least from my experience, that when we wanted to buy something like, especially, you know, 15 tons, you know, that's a lot of penicillin. You know, it's a little different when you walk into the doctor's office and you say, hey, listen, I'd like to get a shot of penicillin. The doctor says, well, that's $35 for one shot, S-H-O-T. One shot of penicillin is $35. Okay, that's one shot. But what if we were going to buy 100,000 shots? Wouldn't we get them for a little bit less than $35? Shouldn't we get them, you know, for $34.95 or $34.50 or something? Doesn't your common sense say that, you know, when you buy things in quantity, you get a little better price? Okay, now, here's Congress. They came out and they made this Medicare deal over here, and they didn't negotiate a quantity discount for Medicare. They're just paying full bore retail. And the people that negotiated that were senators and representatives. You know, those were the people that enacted that in the Congress of the United States. Now, can you point to one congressman or one representative that hasn't been trained in college? Name one. And if there is one, would you send me a letter and tell me who that guy is or who that woman is that's actually gone to Congress and hasn't been to college, doesn't have any letters after his name? You know, I'm not too bright, and I'm a high school dropout, but I'm smart enough to know that if I was in the Congress, I would say, hey, wait a minute, guys, shouldn't we negotiate a quantity discount here? I mean, after all, we're buying for about 50 million people here. It would seem like to me that if you were buying carrots, you know, from somebody and said, I'm going to buy 30 tons of carrots, that we would want some kind of a quantity discount. But somehow or another, all these smart people with the college degrees in the Congress and the President of the United States that signed it into law, they didn't think that a quantity discount was very important. Evidently, they didn't think that the amount of money that you and I as taxpayers was very important that we're sending off to Merck and Pfizer and GlaxoSmithKline. And that kind of ticks me off a little bit. All right, so there's one. Now, let me point out to you that Henry Ford, you know, he was a pretty smart guy. I mean, he built a pretty good-sized company there, the Ford Motor Company. Did you know that Henry Ford only went to the sixth grade? The sixth grade. And there's really a funny little story that goes along with old Henry. In 1913, Henry Ford instituted a project that he called the $5 Workday. Now, you got to remember, in 1913, people were working for a dollar a day. A dollar a day. That was wages. And Henry Ford came along. He couldn't keep people working, and he had this assembly line idea. But he said, you know, I think I'll develop my own workforce over here. And so he offered $5 a day. God awful hard work, but that $5 a day, you know, really made a lot of people mad, because, you know, if you're a businessman and this guy's over here offering $5 a day, you know, and he's a dummy on top of that. I mean, he never went to college and didn't get any letters after his name, you know. He wasn't a lettered man. Crummy sixth grade education. He goes out here and he's hiring people at $5 a day, making cars faster and better than anybody else and cheaper than anybody else. He created a lot of enemies in short order. Well, somebody sued him over this. I don't know exactly how this case came about, but somebody sued him over this policy that he had over here, and they charged that he was an incompetent. He was a nitwit. He was a jerk. He didn't have any letters. And he couldn't run the Ford Motor Company, and that this thing needed to be put into receivership, and that this thing needed to be operated, probably as creditors got after, needed to be operated by paid professionals, somebody that knew somebody, you know, somebody that knew something, somebody with an MBA from the Harvard Business School or something like that. That's the way they run Ford today. They've got MBAs, you know, from the Harvard Business School or Yale or somebody that knows something. And did you notice that all these people with all of these degrees that operate companies like WorldCom and Enron, you know, they run them into the ground and they go bankrupt. And then it costs millions and millions of stockholders a lot of money. And some of them, it costs them their entire life savings and things like that. Keeping in mind, again, that Ken Lay and the people running Enron are all college-trained people, you know, that come from the business schools. Those guys aren't plumbers, carpenters, and electricians and dummies down here putting tar on roofs, you know. Those people don't get their hands dirty. Now, I don't know why those of us with blue collars are running around worshiping all of these jerks because they can run their companies into the ground, because they can run them into bankruptcy and cost millions of people their life savings. And you think that these people are so damn smart that we ought to be following after them? Huh? I mean, hey kids, have we taken leave of our senses? And I'm just getting started here so far. I'm just scratching the surface. I'll get after them doctors and psychologists and psychiatrists and the rest of these screwballs out here as we progress along. I just wanted you to start thinking over here, hey, listen, if these guys are so damn smart, then how come they run these companies, these big multinational corporations, right into the ground? And you'll notice that when these guys leave office, you know, like Ken Lay, I mean, they leave with 50, 60, 100 million bucks in their jeans. I mean, they screw over all the little guys down here at the bottom, and all you little guys at the bottom buying those stocks to start with deserve what you got. You deserve to lose every damn dime because you're practicing unjust weights and balances, which you were strictly and clearly told not to do. You know, if we down here at the lower levels listen to our God for a change and said, hey, don't practice unjust weights and balances like we were instructed in Deuteronomy 25 and Leviticus 19, it never would have happened to us to start with. But since we invested our money in Enron and WorldCom and Global Crossing and the rest of these companies that go upside down, then these leaders, all of these people that are up here in the top management, you know, these people are all college people. They've got degrees after their names. And those of us that are buying the stocks and listening to these stock touts over here, telling us about what great inventions and great investments and how we're going to get rich and how we're going to retire on these investments, you know, when we get old and full of years. And then when the thing turns upside down, don't we learn anything from that? That, hey, we followed after a pack of fools. And these fools stripped us of our wealth. That's what the bottom line is. Well, anyway, old Henry Ford, you know, he's in court. And so the other side got up. I don't know if I was on direct. I guess it would be on cross-examination. Probably on cross-examination. And said, hey, LaFord, you know, you dunderhead, you dumb screwball. This is the way they were painting him. They said, now, Ford, how far in school did you go? And he said, I went to sixth grade. Which, by the way, you know, in 1870, when he was going to school, sixth grade was a pretty good education. My granddad went to the sixth grade, and he was the mill superintendent at Northern Redwood Lumber Company and the Harold Castile Lumber Company. And he had, you know, I don't know, up at Northern Redwood, I'd say out in the yard, he probably had 100 employees working for him. And down at Harold Castile, my guess is that it wasn't as big a company, but I'd guess 50, maybe 75. I know when my granddad died, there was 326 people went to the funeral, biggest funeral I ever saw. Hell, I ain't sure that the mafia dons have 300 people go to those funerals. Presidents do, you know, and politicians. I'm not quite sure why. My old granddad only went to the sixth grade. He could add and subtract. He could count real good, too. I'm married to a woman that she went to school. She didn't get a college degree, but she counts real good, and she can read and write, which is pretty darn good for just a girl, I'd say. Well, my granny, she went to the eighth grade, and she told me that she was pretty good at algebra and geometry in the eighth grade. She's a little better educated than my granddad. She didn't have as good a job as he had, but then, you know, she's just a girl. Now, she went to the eighth grade. My granddad went to the sixth grade. Old Henry Ford went to the sixth grade. And old Henry over here, he's sitting on the witness stand. He told him he only went to the sixth grade. And they said, well, now, Mr. Ford, when you have an engineering problem, now what do you do? And when you have an accounting problem, what do you do? How do you solve that? Well, old Henry, he said, well, I've got on my desk 12 buttons. 12 buttons. And each one of those buttons is hooked up to a paid professional, you know, like an accountant or a lawyer or an engineer. And he said, when I've got an engineering problem, I punch button number 4. And then an engineer comes in and I tell him, here's what my problem is. And he goes out and he solves that problem, comes back and gives me the answer. And whenever I've got a legal problem, I punch button number 8. And then the lawyer comes in and I tell him what my legal problem is. And he goes out and researches the law and he comes back and gives me the answer. And then whenever I've got an accounting problem over here, I punch button number 12 and an accountant comes in, or a CPA, and I tell him what my number problem is, and he goes out and he solves that problem. He comes back and gives me the answer. Says, that's the way I run my company. Well, heck, boys and girls, that's what we call vertically integrated management. Vertically integrated management. That's where you take a bunch of people at Enron, and then you take specialties. You know, like one guy over here is the company controller. Another guy over here, maybe he's the head of the chemistry department. Another guy over here, he's running something else, and on down the line. Ken Lay doesn't have to know a heck of a lot, you know, about chemistry. He didn't have to know very much about accounting. He needed to know a whole lot more than he knew, evidently. But you know, typically, you know, the guy that's running the company over there, he's not too smart. I can remember I used to run a corporation. I had 30 employees, and I didn't know everything that was going on there. I'd call on those people just like Henry Ford did. I didn't have any buttons on my desk. I just got them on the telephone and called them in, you know, say, hey, Milton, I got this problem over here. What's the solution? Hey, Peter, I got the problem over here. Solve this problem for me. And then with those answers, I'd go make my policy decisions and go from there. Heck, isn't that the way the president runs the country? He has a cabinet. He might not know too much about defense, but doesn't he call on his defense secretary and says, hey, we got this problem over here. Let's go solve it. Isn't that the way that works? Well, anyway, old Henry Ford won his case, and just goes to show you that just because you've only got a sixth grade education doesn't mean that we can't build or run or manage or operate a big company like the Ford Motor Company. Now, I got to give you a reminder, and we'll come back and we'll talk about Thomas Edison. He was even worse off than old Henry Ford. He only went to the third grade and had 1,200 patents. Now, how does a fool like that reach that kind of a level of success? We'll talk about that in just a second. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And if you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our webpage. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools altogether. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station, who probably all have degrees from college. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're back. We're talking about college degrees and professionals. Professionals in general, not necessarily the college degree or the fact that you went to college and you wanted to learn something. I'm not opposed to education. After all, I run a school. We're all in favor of education. We think it's the greatest thing since sliced white bread. And that's what I'm talking about here with Henry Ford. You know, Henry Ford, although he didn't go to college and get a degree, do you think he was ignorant? Did you think he was stupid? Did you think he was a fool? And if that was the case, how in the world did he create the size of an organization or the size company turning out a product, you know, a worldwide organization the way he did? No, sirree, Bob. And then there's a second guy over here that caught my attention. His name was Thomas Edison. I don't know of anybody other than Thomas Edison that has 1,200 patents. 1,200. Not 12 patents. You know, if you went out and you invented something like the hula hoop and you got that thing patented, or you invented something like safety glass and you patented that, you know, that would be quite an accomplishment. I've never invented anything. I don't have any patents at all. None. Zero. Not a single patent is in the name of George Gordon. So, you know, I'm not very bright. Never claimed to be. But, you know, I'm nowhere near the level of an inventor. And I've talked to some guys that are inventors and that do have patents. And God, those guys are really pretty bright fellows, you know. They really have to know something. And a lot of those guys go to college in order to learn the things that they need to know. You know, the specialized information, you know, like a guy is a chemist and he uses chemicals over here to do useful, productive, meaningful work, and he gets a patent, you know, he gets for a process that he comes up with, you know, like separating gold from gravel and stuff like that. Well, anyway, this guy, Thomas Edison, he invented such things as the motion picture camera and the light bulb and the phonograph. I mean, hey, listen, kids, that's pretty impressive. And he invented DC motors and DC motor processes, and he held patents on all kinds of neat things that we use every day. And a lot of things that, you know, we don't know much about, you know, they weren't all that successful, or they weren't all that marketable, but there are 1,200 of these patents. A guy went to the third grade, and he was deaf on top of it. The guy's deaf. He's only gone to the third grade. He's got 1,200 patents. He dies a multimillionaire. The name Edison, you know, is synonymous with the light bulb and the phonograph. All right. Now, there's a couple of examples of people, and there's a lot more. I mean, there's literally, you know, millions of very successful people in our history that go back, you know, thousands of years, including Jesus himself, that never went to college and that turned out to be, you know, fairly successful people in life. I just thought I'd throw that out for your consideration, that it isn't necessary that you go to college in order to avoid total failure in life. Now, I never went to college and I never thought of myself as being a total failure in life. I'm not an Edison, and I'm not a Ford, and I'm not a Donald Trump, and I'm not a George Bush or a Donald Rumsfeld. But then, you know, I'm not a bag lady living under a bridge either. My granddad was a pretty successful man in life, and my grandmother was a pretty successful lady. And the world is filled with very successful people that have never gone to college. No one to throw that out there, you know, for your consideration, you know, so that you don't get mad at all of us blue-collar workers, because keep this in mind, all of you people now with letters and degrees, you people don't want to work. Ichthyologists are not out here changing pistons in their engines or pulling transmissions out of their Corvettes and changing them out now, are they? No, sirree, Bob. You know, when people get letters after their names and they're out here, you know, teaching college, you know, they're professors and they get their tenure in one thing and another. You know, those people, they don't want to get their hands dirty and they don't want to do what I call useful, productive, and meaningful meaningful work. Now, Henry Ford did. Thomas Edison did. And I got to tell you here that we've had some pretty successful people in the legal profession. You know, I'm in the legal profession, and so sometimes people say, well, you know, you're kind of hard on lawyers. Well, hell, everybody's kind of hard on lawyers. Lawyers are criminals. Lawyers are not very good people. Now, fortunately, I can say things like that, you know, because I'm not running for public office. But, you know, if I was a politician, you know, like you saw this guy Trent Lott. You know, old Trent Lott a few years back, you know, he went to a birthday party. And Strom Thurmond, who was about 100 years old at this party, Strom Thurmond ran for president of the United States back in 1948 against Harry Truman and Tom Dewey. And old Strom Thurmond, he was a pretty successful guy in life. He was a governor, I think, of North or South Carolina, I forgot which. He was a senator. I think he's about the longest serving senator in the history of the Senate. If not, he was sure close to it. I mean, he was senator until he was about 96 or 98 years old. And Strom Thurmond was a very sincere segregationist. And of course, today segregation, you know, is equivalent to discrimination, and it's about as popular as AIDS in an office Christmas party. But you know, he was one of those, and he let it be known he ran for public office on those grounds, and one thing and another. Well, anyway, as time went on, He got to be old and full of years. He was 100 years old. And Trent Lott went to his birthday party, and he was asked to give a few words over there, and he said something to the effect of, you know, if we had more people like Strom Thurmond over here, you know, the world would be a better place. God, that just made people furious. And even the Republicans turned against him. See, all the blacks turned against him and said, well, that Strom Thurmond was a segregationist, and we represent 12% of the popular vote out here, and so therefore, we need to throw this Trent Lott to the wolves. And so they did. Trent Lott was thrown to the wolves. And I'm not here to eulogize Trent Lott. I've got no use for politicians in general, and I can't say much about him in particular, but I just wanted to point out that politicians, you know, by and large, you know, have degrees after their names, and they're all college people. And how would you like to have friends like that? You go to a guy's birthday party and you say, well, I say some good things about this guy at the birthday party. And then all of a sudden they say, well, we want you to give up your leadership post and we're going to turn against you over here. I thought we had something like free speech that people, we might not agree with him. I don't mind people that don't agree with me. I don't mind people that have disagreements. But shouldn't they have a right to express themselves? I mean, the integrationists feel like they should have the right to free speech and that they should have a right to espouse their views concerning miscegenation and integration and so on. Well, then shouldn't anybody else have a right to express a contrary view without being fired from his job and castigated? So that's another complaint that I have against these people, especially with the degrees, because these people in the Congress, these people with all the degrees over here after their names, they don't seem to be very loyal, and they don't seem to be the kind of people that champion free speech. I don't see that among truck drivers, plumbers, and carpenters. I notice that when we have a group of people over here, and they're blue-collar people, they have very divergent views on these very same topics. But I've never had one say, well, Gordon, you ought to be thrown in prison because of your views, or you know, you ought to be castigated from your job, your occupation, or your profession because of your views or your beliefs. I haven't run across that yet. But you sure find that among the educated elite. Boy, they don't like that. Now, listen, I'm going to give you a little story here about lawyers. 12 lawyers. Here's a list of 12 lawyers and a little story about each one of them, including Strom Thurmond in here. I think he's in here. I'm pretty sure he is. Yeah, Strom Thurmond. Strom Thurmond, he was admitted to the bar in 1930, and he later became governor of South Carolina, then senator from that state. That's quite an accomplishment, you know, to be a governor and a senator. You know, I don't care whether the guy's got a degree from college or not. You know, when you become president of the United States like George Bush, I mean, wow, that's pretty significant. Now, George Bush went to college, but did you know we had some presidents that became president of the United States and they never went to college? You know, Abraham Lincoln never spent a day in college. He became president of the United States. And you know, you go back and you take a look at George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, John Quincy Adams, Andrew Jackson, Martin Van Buren, John Tyler, William Henry Harrison, you know, James K. Polk, Zachary Taylor, Millard Fillmore, Franklin Pierce, James Buchanan. Can you name any of those presidents that went to college, got a college degree? So when did we get off on this thing over here that if you don't have a degree from college, you got to be stupid? You don't know anything. Can you name any college graduates who signed the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution of the United States? There were some. We had colleges and universities back in those days. Yale and Harvard were colleges, and they go clear back to prior to the Revolution. I mean, we've had institutions of higher learning in this country, you know, clear back into colonial times. I'm not suggesting to you, you know, that college is something new, just came about in the Clinton administration. I didn't mean to imply that. We've had them for a long time. I just wanted to point out that there was a time in America that when we had, you know, we had people elected to public office, they didn't always go to college. And here's something that's really hard to believe. You're about to read the names of 12 of our nation's most prominent lawyers. One of these men was a law school dropout. Let's see if you can guess his name. Now, I'm going to read you 12 names here and 12 stories. 12 stories about 12 of the most prominent lawyers in America. Men whose names you're going to recognize right away. Now listen to this. One of these guys is a law school dropout. One of these guys dropped out of law school. One of these guys did not get a degree from law school. Let's see if we can figure out who it was. The first name here is Patrick Henry. He passed his oral bar examination in 1760. And within 3 years had handled more than 1,100 cases. He was a member of the Continental Congress and later governor of Virginia. Now, surely, Patrick Henry could not have been a law school dropout, having been governor of Virginia. And within 3 years of passing his bar examination, handled 1,100 cases. That's John Jay. John Jay was the first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, and he was admitted to the bar in 1768. And subsequently, he distinguished himself as the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Surely John Jay, first Justice of the Supreme Court, could not have been a law school dropout, now could he? John Marshall passed his bar exam in 1780, and he later became a Supreme Court Chief Justice. Come on, kids. Surely, the two most prominent chief justices of our history, John Jay the first and John Marshall the second, served longer, I think, John Marshall did than anybody else. William Wirt, W-I-R-T, was barely 20. Now, you probably, you know, not too familiar with William Wirt. He was barely 20 when he practiced law in Culpeper County, Virginia, and he eventually became United States Attorney General. Attorney General of the United States, a law school dropout? That's crazy. Roger Taney, he was admitted to practice in 1799. He served as first Secretary of the Treasury and then as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Now, here's another. This is the third guy who became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Surely he couldn't have been a law school dropout. Daniel Webster was admitted to the Boston Bar in 1805. He established a phenomenal legal reputation, and also he served as Secretary of State in 1841. Daniel Webster! Webster! Webster's Dictionary! I mean, that's a pretty famous guy. Admitted to the Boston Bar in 1805, established a phenomenal legal reputation, and served as Secretary of State in 1841. Hell, he held the same office as Condoleezza Rice does today. And then there was Salmon P. Chase. He gained his early prominence as a defense attorney for runaway slaves and also later became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Salmon P. Chase. Abraham Lincoln, he gained his experience as a lawyer and became the 16th President of the United States. Now that's the guy that's probably the law school dropout. I'll just bet you it's Abraham Lincoln. Just tuck that one away in your heart now. Wait a second. Stephen Douglas. Remember the famous Lincoln-Douglas debates? Well, Stephen Douglas was admitted to the bar in 1834. He later became a representative and then a senator from Illinois. And he's best remembered for his debates with Abraham Lincoln. Remember, it was called the Lincoln-Douglas debate. Clarence Darrow was a lawyer of world renown whose most famous case was the Scopes case. Remember the Scopes monkey trial? Well, back in 1925, William Jennings Bryan was defending the school board. Excuse me. He was defending the creation point of view, and Clarence Darrow was representing Scopes, the school teacher who was teaching evolution in the public school. And he was representing the evolutionary point of view. That was Clarence Darrow. Clarence Darrow. Well, anyway, Clarence Darrow, lawyer of world renown, whose most famous case was the Scopes trial, the so-called monkey trial of 1925. Then there's Robert Story. Robert Story was born in 1893. He served as president of the American Bar Association in 1952. And in 1953. Well, you know, a guy that's the president of the American Bar Association could not be a law school dropout, now could he? And then Strom Thurmond. Remember I told you about him a little earlier. Strom Thurmond was admitted to the bar in 1930. He later became governor of South Carolina, then senator from that state. Now remember, one of these distinguished gentlemen is a law school dropout. He abandoned law school after the first year, never to return. Only went to law school 1 year. One of these famous men is a law school dropout. Listen, Patrick Henry, John Jay, John Marshall, William Wirt, Roger Taney, Daniel Webster, Salmon P. Chase, Abraham Lincoln, Stephen Douglas, Clarence Darrow, Robert Story, or Strom Thurmond. Which one of those 12 do you think was a law school dropout? Well, here's the answer. Clarence Darrow was that dropout. That's right. Clarence Darrow is the one name that the whole world associates with the practice of law. He attended law school for only 1 year, and he never distinguished himself, and he dropped out to study law on his own. Okay, so it was Clarence Darrow. But, in concluding, we should point out that the other 11 distinguished American lawyers could not have dropped out of law school. They could not have dropped out of law school because they never attended law school at all. Now, did you get that, boys and girls? 12 of the most famous lawyers in American history, one of them went to law school, Clarence Darrow, for 1 year. The other 11, including 4 chief justices of our Supreme Court, 4 chief justices, never spent a single day in law school. Hell, I'll bet you they never spent a single day in college. Most of them. Now, again, I want to emphasize to those of you that are college grads and you have degrees after your name that I'm not making fun of you now. Not suggesting that you wasted all of your time there, although it's a good possibility that you wasted some of your time there. I mean, you can figure that out for yourself. And there are some people that went to college and they learned some good stuff and they came out and they invented some very good, useful, productive items. But I'm going to make a point and I'm going to make a distinguishing characteristic here that just because you've got a degree after your name doesn't mean that I necessarily want to follow after you. And if you'll notice in the last election, I'm not so sure that the majority of Americans want to follow after George Bush and the Iraq policy or the Republican policy. And all of those people have degrees after their names. And I'm pointing out to you that just because people have degrees after their names does not mean that they've got all the answers. Now, you just take a look at one more subject over here called medicine. Now, we've been told by the paid professionals, starting from President Nixon in 1972 or 73, that he was going to declare war on cancer. Do you remember that? And we're now spending federal tax monies on this war on cancer. And all of the people who are involved in the war on cancer are college graduates. I'll just bet you that there's not a single person that is engaged in any scientific pursuit in any institution, any hospital, any clinic, any research facility in this country engaged in the war on cancer, any scientist who's engaged in this operation collecting federal tax dollars for his paycheck, not a single one of them hasn't got a college degree. And they've been working on this problem for 40 years and they haven't come up with a cure to cancer yet. But do you know there's 9 cures to cancer? And I've laid all 9 of those cures to cancer out here on the air. And 7 of the 9 were discovered by medical doctors who did go to college. So of the 9 cures to cancer, 7 of the 9 cures were discovered by college graduates who have medical degrees and are medical doctors, and not a single one of those cures to cancer is tolerated by, used by, or practiced by a single medical doctor in the United States of America or the American Medical Society today. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, what the hell's going on here, kids? Why is it that we have cures to cancer that we can't use, and we have billions of dollars being spent on cancer research that we can't find a solution to? What the hell's going on here? And all these people have degrees. You know, if I had a guy working on my job and I sent him out here to find a solution to a problem, I mean, if we had an engineer over here that was on the staff and we said, hey, listen, we got an engineering problem, go out here and solve this problem, the guy comes back and he doesn't have a solution, there's not a one of them that could hold his job, we'd fire him. If I sent a plumber out and said, go fix this problem out here, and the guy came back and said, well, we've been looking and looking and working and working, and we just couldn't find the solution to the problem, boss, we'd can him. Now, why is it that we can hire scientists for decade after decade after decade to find a solution to a problem? I mean, hell, when the Air Force comes to a Lockheed and says, we need an airplane that does this and such, they build it. When they came to the Lockheed people and said, we need an airplane that goes Mach 3, that can run out faster than a speeding bullet, they went out and they built the SR-71. That was a success story, kids. They didn't come back and say, gee, we failed after billions of dollars, but you haven't got a cure to cancer, but you got an SR-71. Mull that one over for a while, would you? We'll mull that one over till tomorrow night, and then we'll come back tomorrow night and tell you some more of the story on the professionals. But in the meantime, let me remind you that you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. And The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's about up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back there tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.